Gentlemen on the rail at a jog, please on the rail at a jog.
Hello, everyone. We have another episode of On the Rail podcast. Super excited about our guests today. I'm eager to learn more and hear about their business and how they do all of the amazing things that we hear about. So without further ado, I'll let them introduce themselves. And then if you guys want to just give a little bit of background and some achievements maybe, and just a little bit about how you got started in the horses even, that would be great.
Right now we live in Camden, South Carolina. I was born and raised about 20 miles east of here. Me and my wife Paisley operate Mathis Show Horses. We started it in December of 2009. 2019. Jeez.
That's close.
Good Lord.
Feels like that little bit of years, right?
Oh my gosh. Y'all got me nervous. But anyway, I'm trying to think of, I grew up, my dad ran a state park in Bishopville, which is, like I said, 20 miles east of where we live right this second. And we had horse trails and everything there, but he ran that state park and I didn't know horse training or horse showing was a real thing. We just grew up trail riding. We always had horses. And years later, I found out my mom actually, for a period of her life, lived in Fort Worth and worked actually for Sean Ryan, the saddlemaker's dad in Fort Worth. She got to watch smart little Lena win the cutting fraternity. She can shape hats. She knows how to make boots. Like, she learned all kinds of stuff that I didn't even know. Like, I didn't even know that was a thing until I grew up and got my first pair of Rod Patrick boots, and my mom looked at them. She's like, this is a well-made boot. And how do you know? And that's how we figured that out. Like, I was like, anyway, but yeah, we grew up there trail riding. And then I think I was 9 years old. There was a show, there's an arena in that park. And when I say arena, it's literally carved out of about 25 million pine trees. There's one little clear spot. It's a big oval with white fence around it, and that is the show pen. They call it the show pen down there. And they would have open shows, and when I was about 7 or 8, my parents had bought a piece of property that adjoined that state park. It was kind of across the road, and they would take me to the barn that we had built on that place, and they would drop me off, and then my dad would say, okay, I'll meet you at the show pen. And I would ride through the woods. And that's what we did on Friday or Saturdays and Sundays, is they drop me off, make sure I got on my horse, help me get across. And then I'd ride across the road into the woods, and we'd cut across 2,500 acres of trails. And then I'd meet him at the show pen. He'd make sure I was alive and I was allowed to go for all day. I had to report back in at lunch and I could ride as long as I wanted to. But anyway, one day they did that. I rode in and there was a horse show going on. My dad didn't think to tell me anything about that. He didn't think anything of it. He just knew there'd be activity there and I'd like to be there. So he sent me, they saddled up and I rode in there and I had no clue what was going on whatsoever. But that was the first time I got to see a horse show. And then maybe like the next weekend or the weekend after, it wasn't very long, the local 4-H group had a meeting, their year-end meeting, awards banquet, whatever, was held in the conference room there at that state park. And some folks had gotten a hold of my parents that actually had been at that horse show. And they were like, hey, you should bring Adam to that meeting. And that's where I started. Was, I think we went to that 4-H meeting. And then a couple of months later, we went to my very first open show. And I went in the 9 and under walk jog or something. We had no clue what we were doing. And I won the walk jog. And I was hooked ever since then. I think my mom and my dad still have a picture of that in their house. But ever since then, I was like, man, this is it right here. So I knew at 9 years old, as soon as I figured it out. I still didn't know you could hire a horse trainer. I had no clue about any of that. I just knew, I thought I was going to be a professional horse shower. I didn't know.
Living every amateur's dream at that point, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and see, we didn't even have a truck or a trailer. When we started really open showing, we'd have to bum rides with people. So they would take me down to the barn from our house, and I would ride to the edge of our property where the driveway was, and I would unsaddle my horse and I would stack, put the stuff on the side of the road, or we'd put it in the back of my mom's car. And then whoever we knew that was going to that horse show, they would drive by and stop on the road, and I'd load my horse in their trailer and we'd go to the horse show. Yeah, that's kind of how we got started. And then just kind of developed from there. We went from 4-H to breed shows. When we went to the first breed show, saw my very first horse trainer. And then I ended up sending him a horse. His name's Jody Capps. And then he ended up being like a second father to me. Him and his wife, Karen, did a lot for me, gave me a lot of opportunities. And then when I decided to go out and not go to college, they really had a lot to do with where I went and tried to put me in the right places to start working with people. And that was the beginning of it for me. So there you go, Freckles. It's all on you now.
Hi, I'm obviously Paisley Mathis. My parents are horse trainers. Now they live in West Milton, Ohio, Timberland Poudreau. So got to be very fortunate in all horse senses. I was obsessed with them from day one, from as long as I can remember, and pictures that I can't even remember. I was always in the barn. That was the only place I ever wanted to be. And my parents obliged, luckily. I always had a pony or horse or both and started showing. I think the first time I showed, I was 2 or 3 and never stopped. And they were great. I owe everything to them as far as they always made me figure out how to work through problems and know that you're never going to know it all. And they always were very adamant about encouraging me to learn, and that you will never know how to handle every horse because every horse is different, and you should always keep an open mind and continue to just learn another way. There's always another way. So when I was, I don't know, I think I was 18 or 19, I decided that they specialize in kind of the all around. And I grew up showing the all around. And then I decided that I really kind of liked the Western Pleasure. Really wanted to try and focus on that, maybe make that my thing. So moving forward, they started telling me to figure out who I wanted to go work for, because I was not allowed to just hang my sign just because I had horse trainers from parents. So I think I went to work for Brian and Don when I was 19-ish. Spent 3 years with them and learned so much. And then after that, I went to Angie and Charles Canizzaro in Oklahoma and spent, I believe, 5 years with them. They were amazing. And then ended up at Gil and Becky Galleons, was there with Adam. And that's kind of how we started our dating and went on from there. But
We were dating before you came to Gil and Becky's.
Okay.
Did that play in a role in why she ended up at Gil's?
You're gonna learn. I am no part Rain Man at all, but dates I'm good with.
I was just here to say Adam is much better with dates than I am. I remember horses and that's about it. I'm not good at remembering the rest of it. But I've been around it forever and I'm very grateful to everybody that's ever played a part in teaching me all the things that I've learned.
Awesome. So we're going to pause you there. And then I want to hear about how Adam ended up at Gil's eventually. But before we dive into that, I do have a question for you guys, because Paisley, you came from a background that was horse trainers and from the get-go, and Adam kind of the opposite. So do you guys ever, have you had like conversations about the different types of background and your different perspectives on things? Does that still affect your take on things today, or is it more just funny things, or kind of what's that experience been like for you guys as a couple?
100% for me. Adam might have a different opinion. I think that for me, getting to be around it every day in a business fashion, my parents made me learn, and don't get me wrong, I got bucked off of plenty of horses, but it was always in a very supervised manner. I was always on a show type horse. And I think Adam learning in just like the backyard trail riding manner, there's a lot of stuff that is second nature for me that I didn't even think about, that he'll talk when we talk about horses in the beginning, the stuff that he had to learn, like I definitely took for granted because I know me to remember learning that. It was just, that's how it was. And that's how you did things.
Like I remember it freaking me out. It really freaked me out. And now that we had bad horses, like looking back now, they weren't. We had one really good one, and I say really good one in that she was, her name was Angel, and she was an angel. Like, that horse was amazing. If it hadn't been for that horse, I probably wouldn't be a horse trainer. But like, it freaked me out when we went to the horse show and there were people standing behind their horses brushing tails. Like, I was taught that's how you get kicked. Like, you don't do that. Like legitimately, like the horses, like, and I'm not saying we had, like I said, we didn't have bad horses. It just, it's a whole different ball game, like whole different ball game. And so like the things that I kind of learned how to deal with or not deal with. And then like what I see as a problem a lot of times, Pez is like, oh, like, you know, she doesn't see it as a problem because she can already see where it comes through that. And I think sometimes I second guess that because, you know, she had 18 years in front of me. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't start. I mean, she was, before I ever started trying to train a horse, I think I started doing some colt breaking-ish stuff when I was 16, but I mean, that was my first forte into it. So by that point, you know, it was just about survival, legitimately. Like, if it wants to hurt you, get in a spot where it's not going to hurt you. It wasn't about teaching them how to not hurt you. It was about how to, like, let them kind of do their deal and make sure you ride down the trail and enjoy it versus, you know, you don't turn left if they don't turn left. Like, just turn right, like make three right hand turns to get to the left side. Like, you know, like, it was just about survival. Like, now, I think sometimes Paisley's a little bit quick to let, or not quick, but she very much, her horses have a lot more personality. I think that's where I see it is in the finished product. Her horses will have a lot of personality on the ground or even on their back. And for me, I don't think about it. It's more of a subconscious thing. I just think about it as a way of, like, you know, I don't want somebody else that's not aware of those things. Like, if they do something, I want to be able to make sure that they're not going to try anything. That's always in the back of my mind. You know, Paisley probably doesn't think about that. Like, I think about it, like, if somebody picks this horse's tail up, it better not move. Like, meanwhile, Paisley walks behind them all the time and switches their tail. She doesn't think about it. You know what I mean? Like me, I'll sacrifice talent for obedience, where Paisley's like, hold on, we can get obedience without sacrificing talent. You just need a little more time.
So, I love that. We'll come back into that, but this was also like a little bit of a perfect segue. So for you, Adam, your journey into horse training, it sounds like you weren't initially planning on being a horse, like a show horse type trainer. It was just horse trainer. So what's your journey from starting breaking horses, even for trail riding or that type of thing, up to like elite futurity level Western pleasure trainer?
Well, so there was never, you can ask anyone that has known me my entire life, I was going to wear a cowboy hat one way or the other. At the time, back in the day, it was the Bud Light Cup on TV every Friday and Saturday night on OLN or whatever that was. And it was bull riding. And I thought that's what you had to do. I thought you had to ride bulls. But I thought I was going to be like, there's tons of home videos of me saying, Adam, what are you going to be? I'm going to be a bull rider. And then I figured out I'm scared. So I didn't like that. But in all actuality, I figured out that you could show horses. I was like, okay. Like, it never occurred to me to be a quote unquote horse trainer. I didn't know that you could get paid to do it. And I'm talking about like between the ages of 9 and 16. I tell you what really got me started as far as the first thought in my mind of training horses was we had some horses that we'd ended up with a yearling. She was halter bred and I wanted the starter, and my mom and dad both have been extremely supportive and whatever my sister and I do. And they were all about it. And they said, you can start this horse, but the first thing you have to do, that was right around the time RFD TV was coming out big. And my mom and dad both really liked Clinton Anderson. So I wasn't allowed to start that filly on my own until they bought me for Christmas the Clinton Anderson Colt Starting 101 DVD set. And I had to watch that DVD set twice And as soon as I got it done twice, then I was allowed to start. And that led into, and I mean, that thing was bronchi. Like it could buck. There again, I didn't realize that I was developing a skill. I just knew I enjoyed it. That turned into, there was a lady that had asked me to start a couple of, her horse trainer had quit. They had a horse in-house horse trainer, and he had quit or got fired or whatever. And she had some extra colts left over. I wasn't trying to get paid. I looked at it as free horses to ride. Mr. Jody kind of steered me toward that. By that point, we had horses in training with Mr. Jody. He kind of steered me toward that. If you want to try it, try that. And we did. I would go to his house every Friday, every Saturday. I got a job at the movie theater in town because that was the only job I could have. I could work there at night and still ride horses during the day. So I could ride all day at Mr. Jody's and then go to work at night. And anyway, long story short, he kind of pushed me. He was like, hey, why don't you go see if that lady needs some help? You know, I looked at it as a way not to make money, as a way to get horses to ride. And I didn't get paid there, but she gave me a horse for starting all those horses. And I immediately borrowed a truck and borrowed a trailer and took it to Mr. Jody. And I was like, look what I got. He's like, oh God, now we're going to build this. Like, yes. And that was how I got a youth horse to show. She actually took me quite a ways in the state level horse shows. But that's kind of how I forte'd into it. I just realized after mom and dad put a horse in training, I realized that was the thing. It wasn't necessarily a decision on Western pleasure necessarily. I didn't care what I did. I loved any and everything to do with horses. Like, I loved the cow horse. I loved the cutting. I loved the roping. Just in our area, I mean, I loved it all. In our area, you're either going to be a hunter jumper or you're going to show pleasure horses, because there's not a whole lot of cattle. And I wasn't going to go put, the hunter jumper stuff didn't interest me as much as the pleasure stuff did. And once I rode my first trained pleasure horse, they had put me on something. I was like, holy crap, this is hard. That more than anything, I think that was the biggest thing, is like, okay, this is hard, but I feel like I can achieve it. I mean, up until then, the only other thing that I was really passionate about was baseball. I love baseball. Other than that, that was the only two things that could keep my focus for more than 3 months. So that's kind of how I went into it. Western pleasure was just the thing at hand. You know, if I'd have grown up in maybe Weatherford or somewhere like that, you know, if I'd have grown up in Texas, I might have been a cutting horse trainer. It was just what was here and what we could afford to go do. So that's where I went.
So how did you end up at Gills?
So when I was 18, I had to write out a pretty serious plan. I took my mom and my dad out to eat. We were sitting there at the table and it's getting down to, it's like January. We're getting down to chop time here. My dad, by that point, had retired from the state park. He was running the show facility here in Camden. He had met Shane Pope's dad, Johnny Pope. He knew who he was. And we sat down, and my dad was pretty adamant that I needed to go to school. I've got an uncle, Glenn Evans. He's a fairly successful contractor that didn't go to school. And so my mom, I think, was a little more like, hey, if he really wants to do this, it's okay. But my dad was like, hey, listen, you need the paperwork. So I sat him down and I had a plan. That's, my dad's big on plans. So I had a plan. I said, listen, if you want me to go to school, that's fine. I'll go to school. But here's the deal. I haven't applied anywhere everybody else has. My SAT score is decent. It's not great. It's not bad. But I have no scholarship money. So you guys are going to have to help me. But if you want me to go to school, I'll go to school for 4 years and I will try hard. But when I get out, I'm going to do this again. Or you can let me do this right now and use that money that you're going to have to help me with to help me do this. And my dad kind of looked at me. It was the first time he kind of looked at me. He was like, all right, where are you going to go? And I was like, you know, 2 months, give me 2 months and I'll find out. I go to talking. Well, you know, I talked to Mr. Jody and said, if you called around and asked, and anyway, he kind of directed me towards Shane Pope. Shane Pope was in Ocala, Florida at the time. And Shane was pretty open to it. Didn't really need a body at the time, but I'd talked to him and I didn't know it. My dad had talked to Shane's dad, Johnny, at a horse show. And, you know, those two behind closed doors, my dad was kind of like, hey, is Shane going to take care of my son? And Johnny's like, yes, without a doubt, he's going to take care of your son. I know this is a good spot. And so they asked me to come work at the Little Fraternity in Raleigh. And I worked there for him for that horse show. And at the end of that, he offered me a job. And I met him at the Big A. I went home and packed the rest of my stuff that fit into a Chevrolet S10 pickup. Actually, no, that's a lie. My mom and dad dropped me off at that horse show at the Big A. Everything I own fit into two duffel bags. And they dropped me off at the Big A horse show in Conyers, Georgia. And we left there. We went to the Southern Bell. And we left there. And we went back to Ocala, Florida. And we showed all summer long. I worked for free for Shane for 2 years. He gave me a place to stay. I slept on a Wicker Love seat. And he gave me a truck to drive. And he fed me one meal a day. The rest of the meals were on me. Like, I had to take care of those. But he's going to make sure I didn't starve to death. Gave me a truck to drive, a place to stay, and the opportunity to learn. And I'm forever grateful for that. We ended up moving back to his home in Conway, South Carolina. And I think I worked for Shane for like 6 years. And then, I eventually started. After 2 years, I got paid. And then I just kind of progressed through that. And then it was kind of getting about that time. I'm forever grateful to Shane for that reason. He knew I was going to leave. And he still gave me the opportunities that he gave me, just like Gil did. I don't know why God put the people he put in my life in my path, but it was those decisions that a lot of people struggle with were always easy for me because those doors just opened. And then the people that are around me didn't try to hold me there. They allowed me to walk through those doors. They cared enough about me as a person to let me walk through those doors. And that wasn't a planned thing. That was just kind of like, I got lucky. And so the opportunity arose there at Gill's. Talked to Denton. Denton told me, like, hey, actually, Paisley and I, we'll get into that, I guess, later, but Paisley and I had met by that point. Paisley and I were best friends at the time. And she was actually at that point already working for Charles and Angie. And I called her and she said, yeah, I did hear that Gill's looking. And she told me, just from friend to friend, she was like, Adam, that's an opportunity. You need to take that. Like, I get, and the Pope family to me is like family, but you need to take that. Like, I know that's going to be hard to get out of there, but you need to go. And so I talked to Shane about it. Shane thought it was a good idea. And I left. Gil hired me. And I think, I can't remember how long I worked for Gil. It was either 5 or 6 years. And that's kind of how I landed in Purcell. And I think of those years at Purcell as maybe the best time of my life. I mean, I owe the Galyon family a lot. I think the world of the Galyon family. Like I said, I've been really, really lucky. There's a lot of horror stories about things, and I have none of those. You know, I was really lucky to work for great people and never really put myself in a position to, it was strictly platonic too. It wasn't a planned thing. I just never got put in a position for it to go wrong. Not to say that I'm extremely successful, because I don't think that I think I've had a lot of luck, but I don't think that I am extremely successful. I just think there's a lot of people that have had opportunities that maybe had other things pulling on them that they couldn't capitalize on. And I've been really lucky that I've always been in a position to where if the door opens, the people around me are like, hey, yeah, absolutely, go for it. So that's kind of how I ended up in Purcell.
Both of your stories is how much time you guys spent as assistant trainers. And it, from a, I guess, outsider amateur level perspective, and maybe, you know, we're all getting old enough now, we're like, these darn kids. It doesn't seem like people want to invest 5, 6, 10 years on being an assistant before they go out on their own sometimes. And so I commend both of you. Was that ever something that you struggled with? Like, when's the right time to do your own business, or you were fully invested in the learning, or what?
Yes. Well, yes and no. So both of us, like I said, my parents were very adamant for me to work for somebody. And Adam and I both, like he said, well, I'm sure we'll get into that more, but we actually became friends when he was working for Shane and I was working for the Bakers. We just met at a horse show and we're friends. So we actually talked a lot, and we both were very adamant. And like the people that we kind of surrounded ourselves with had always told us to really learn a program when it comes to young horses, especially, but any program, I think You have to be there for years. One year does not constitute learning a program. So we both really wanted to, whenever we went somewhere, we wanted to be there long enough to truly learn the program, to understand it, so that we could apply it.
And I think after 1 year, if you go to somebody's place for 1 year, and maybe this is a harsh way or putting it in the lamest terms, but I've told people that in the past, if you go somewhere for a year, you're at the end of that year, you're learning how to stay out of the way. You don't know the program. You're just learning how to be where you need to be to not get your butt chewed. Like, and that, I think that's how it should be. I mean, you're not an asset at the end of year two, beginning of year three, you're just finally starting to be able to become an asset to somebody, like where they can say they can trust you with two tasks a day and trust that you're going to get them done is the way I think about it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, no, you're good. I mean, it's definitely something I think, and it makes me laugh because I do the same thing too. I'm like, well, maybe it's just because we're getting older now that we think that way, but it definitely doesn't seem like the younger generation really wants to invest the same amount of time. And then when you talk to people that are the generation before us, they say the same thing
about us
that, yeah, you know, we wanted everything given to us. But like I said, I know the people that we kind of grew up with and around all worked for people for years. I mean, Adam and I both have 10 plus years as being an assistant before we ever tried to start our own business. You know, obviously Adam worked with Aaron and Denton. Then both of them had more than 10 years working as an assistant for people before they tried. People that are in our generation all worked for somebody for a very long time. If they're out there being successful right now, I don't really know very many people that are hugely successful that worked for somebody for 1 or 2 years and then just said, now I'm ready to do it on my own. I think the time is a key part of learning how to navigate it, because being a horse trainer is hard. I mean, you have to love horses, but there is so much more than just loving horses that goes into being a horse trainer. It is such a hard job.
Yeah. Yes. I 100% agree with you guys. And not that I'm a horse trainer, but there's a reason I'm not a horse trainer. It's because I wouldn't want to do what you guys are doing on a daily basis. So you guys are end up both at Gills. And at what point then are you guys dating at some point? And how does that end from there to getting married, launching your own business?
So you want me to handle this?
Well, to my memory, he'll correct me.
Oh, God, here we go. This will be good.
We started
dating. This is always the best.
Yeah. Hey, let me get over here where you can't slap me. Go ahead.
Well, like I said, we were friends for a very long time.
We met in 2012, September 2nd, at the Reichert Celebration. I can show you the exact alleyway where I saw Paisley. And this is no joke. I was working for Shane Pope. It was the year they showed Mechanic in the 250. And I came back. And I told Shane, I'm going to marry that girl. And I fell in love with her. And she looked at me like, boy, you lost your mind. And we became, after she shot me down, I got friend zoned for a long time. And I was okay with that. I really was. Like, so anyway.
So we were friends. And then after just a long time, especially, we were really friends. We got a lot closer when I was working for Angie and Charles and he was working for Gil, because obviously we both lived in Purcell. So we just hung out a lot, got to actually just be around each other a lot more. We started dating. Adam will remember the year. I was still working for Angie and Charles, but it was, I think, the last year that I worked for them that we started dating. And then it was kind of happenstance going to work for Gil. I'm a big planner. It wasn't technically my plan. I had kind of envisioned going to start my own business after I left Angie and Charles.
And boy, I screwed that up.
But long story short, Gil kind of needed another set of hands. And I was dating Adam. And it just kind of made sense to try and go work there. Plus, obviously, Gil and Becky, and I was like, it can't hurt. I mean, I knew it would be a great thing to go and work for them. I don't want to undersell that at all, because I absolutely, honestly wish I could have spent more years there, because I don't feel like I got to be there long enough to really, I didn't get to be there as long as I was at the other places I worked. But again, it was just, it was great. I was grateful for the 2 years I was there, but it was just because it kind of came in out of left field for me. It wasn't my original plan.
Is your fitness holding back your writing? Discover Write Fit Life. We tailor fitness coaching for writers. Balance writing with life, shed fat, and bid farewell to feeling overwhelmed. With personalized nutrition and fitness plans, boost your physical strength and mindset to add joyful years to your writing career. Be proud of who you see on the saddle. Plus, join our Fitness and Fat Loss for Equestrians Facebook group for free resources. Ready to elevate your writing? Visit RideFitLife.com now. Your fitter, happier writing life is just a click away.
And I don't want to speak for Paisley here at all, but I do think from the outside looking in, when we were in that position there and needed a second set of hands there, Gills, Paisley's been in the exact same situation. We're really lucky. Everybody that we work for, we have a great relationship with now. I mean, like, it's the only difference is now we don't live there and work for them. But other than that, it is absolutely no different. We love the people. Like, the people that we work for are like family to us. And I know that Angie and Charles both thought enough of Paisley to, like, hey, why don't you, you know, Gil's fixing to be looking. You need to make that decision. Like, you know, we've got more help, maybe more so maybe than we need. And that'd be a really good place to go on top of me, you know, me already being there. It just fit really well is what it looked like. I mean, I can't undersell Charles and Angie on that either.
Right.
I mean, those people are like, they are like family to us. We think the world of everybody we work for, but I do think that Charles and Angie played a part in that decision-making process as well.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, if he's 100% correct, like I said, we were very fortunate, and everybody that we worked for, I don't think either one of us felt like we couldn't. I mean, it's always nerve-wracking to have serious conversations with your boss, but we never felt like we couldn't. And because of that, I think that's why we're so close with the people that we work for. Besides the fact that you're with them so much, you learn how to communicate with them. And like Adam said, we consider all those people family, and we still talk to them pretty regularly, every single one of them.
Yeah.
They're always our go-tos whenever we have a question or...
And it can be a question about anything, really.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know what to do with a customer, or you don't know what to do with this horse, or... And what really is nice to me is that I'll have a horse, maybe Paisley videos me, and I personally never worked for Angie and Charles, but I'll have a horse and I'll look at it, and in my mind, I see, like, if I were to think I need to try and sell this horse, I bet Angie would like that horse. It looks like a horse that Angie would like, if that makes sense. And so I'll take that video and I'll send it to Miss Angie, and Angie gives me feedback just like if I were to have worked for her. Like, she'll give me feedback and say, look, this is what I like, this is what I don't like. And she doesn't have to do that. You know, when you work for somebody, you give them part of you. If you're doing it right, you're vested. You give them, there's no stock to buy, so you're not bought into their company, but you give part of yourself to that program. And I never gave part of me to Charles and Angie's program, but they treat me just like I did. And if Paisley needs help with something, or I know for a fact that everybody that I work for would do the same for Paisley. It just created such a network of people to lean on. It was crazy for the both of us, really. I mean, it's not just horses either. It's all things. It's really different, and it's different in a good way, I think.
On the relationship side between you two, so it sounds like you guys mixed business with pleasure long before you even launched your own business. So what was the time frame and the amount of time you guys spent together at Gills? And then when did maybe marriage happen, own training business, that kind of thing?
So feel like I'm going to handle this one because it's got dates in it. I asked Paisley to marry me in 2000, the end in December. We came home for Christmas. And I, 2018, because you worked for Gil for that year. And I came home. My dad pulled me off to the side and said, hey, first of all, don't screw that up. Second of all, you need to do something here. Like, I would not, I'd probably, that'd be the one I'd pick. If you're going to marry somebody, that'd be the one. Like, getting about that time. Like, she might get smart here in a minute. You're going to have a problem. And I'm like, okay. So I asked Paisley to marry me in 2018. And I told nobody about it. And we came home. I didn't realize that that was the thing to do. It was like, hey, I'm going to ask Paisley to marry me. I like, legitimately, it was a shock to everybody other than my mom and my dad. And then we came back to Purcell. And then we worked out the duration of 2019. And then I say the duration, we worked through the world show. I think we told Gil in right before the NSVA.
August.
Yeah, right before the NSVA, we told Gil and Becky. And you want to talk about scared. That was nerve wracking for me. Oh my gosh, that was awful.
How long had you guys been engaged at that point?
December of 18 to the end of July.
So a long time. I mean, that's a while to keep that a secret. Yeah.
We were engaged for over 2 years before we finally got married. Because we didn't get married until we actually moved to South Carolina, started our business. I will say, I think that when we actually started dating, because we had been friends for so long, I already knew Adam's goals and he knew mine. We knew, I had never been in a relationship where I knew so much about somebody before I started dating them. So it was kind of, it's why it worked, but it was so odd at the same time because I knew him so well, but that is also why it worked. And so we already knew, I knew he wanted to be a horse trainer. He knew I wanted to be a horse trainer. So when we got engaged, it was like, okay, when do we want to start our own business? Where do we want to start? Like there was never we both knew that's what we wanted to do. It was just a matter of when do we want to try and start it? How do we want to try and start it?
I don't think the end of 2019 was really when we planned on it necessarily. The big thing, if I'm remembering correctly, and it could change, but if I'm remembering correctly, we'd had several people, either individuals or farms, offer us jobs.
In-house training
kind of situation. Or like, hey, come run y'all's business out of our barn and we'll give you horses to ride also. And I remember that was so weird to me. And that's kind of what you were talking about earlier with the differences. Paisley kind of knew that was already going to happen because she grew up in the show horse world. I didn't know that. I mean, I'd had people try to hire me, from the time that I worked through Shane. People had always run at me with money, but I was always happy where I was and money didn't really matter to me. So why would I leave? This deal here, I'm like, oh, like now money matters because you're trying to build your life. And I'm like, golly. And it didn't even occur to me at that point. And we just kind of one day sat down and, about this time, I guess it was about this time of year. And you were like, Haley and I just kind of had a conversation. Like, what do we want to do? Because we wanted to give Gil and Becky enough time to find somebody. You want to give them enough notice. And to us, this is the time of the year that you make that decision to leave at the end of the year. And the end of the year being, you're going to maybe you tell them in July or August, but you need to be thinking about it from this time of the year to July or August so that you can tell them so that you can have plans for December. Like if you're going to leave in December, it needs to be on your mind right now. And right now is what, March, April? I mean, it was just kind of the time of the year and we kind of thought about it. I don't know. Like, is that what we want to do? We talked about it for a long time. And then by June, we kind of had a decision made-ish. And then that led into telling them in August. Like, I felt comfortable enough that Paisley's the cool go with the flow type of person. I am not. I am about some things. There's a lot of things that don't bother me, but what bothers me really bothers me. And if I don't know the direction I'm going, that bothers me. Like, I get worried, and I worry about it a lot. So big thing was that for us, for me. And once I got a plan together and I actually realized that, you know, we had several people that said, hey, when you guys go, we'll send you horses. Well, when I had enough when I had enough horses that if I charged X amount of dollars a month, and Paisley kind of said it, she goes, look, you make this much money a month. If you can't survive off of that, then maybe you shouldn't be a horse. If you don't think you're surviving off this much money a month, if you don't think that we can keep that number of horses so that you can continue to survive off of that much money a month, I don't think you should be a horse trainer. And she didn't say it quite in those manners. It was much more eloquently put, but that's how I heard it. And I'm like, she's exactly right. Like, if I can't keep two horses in training, because that's what it would amount to, the number of the dollars that I was making is two horses in training. If I can keep two horses in training, why am I doing this? So at that point, I kind of got on board, and then I, you know, well, where do we want to be and where do we want to go? And so all those decisions got made for me, because when I went to Gil, I wanted to be able to tell him, you know, this is our plan. Because more so than anything, I never thought he thought it was a bad idea, because he's always told us, you're ready. I just wanted his advice. Like, this is my plan. Is that a bad idea? And to Gil and Becky both's credit, they've been nothing but honest ever, like, about that. Like, Adam, I don't know if or Paisley, I don't know if y'all should do this. Have you thought about doing this? Or have you thought about doing that? And steering us in the right direction, along with our parents and everybody else. But that was my big thing. I wanted to have a plan so that if my plan wasn't a good idea in the people that I worked for's eyes, I wanted them to tell me that, because I leaned on them just as much as anybody else. So that's kind of how it came together.
How has it been running a training business with your spouse?
Four years of marital bliss.
It always is.
I tell my parents on multiple occasions that they made it look easy.
Your parents are terrible.
Yeah, my parents made it look so easy. I heard them
false advertising.
On occasion, but I mean, it was so rare. They were so good about not fighting in front of me or my brother. I knew that there was disagreements, obviously, but I never really heard them. So yeah, now that it's amazing to me. I tell people all the time, yes, I grew up with horse trainers for parents and I spent all that time working for people, but even still, when you finally start your own business and it's your name on the sign and your responsibility to take care of those horses, and you have to answer all those phone calls of people wanting to know about their individual, there's no preparing you for that. It is so much. It can be so overwhelming, and it's a lot. I feel like we've grown exponentially since the time that we started our business, but there is no way to describe working with your spouse every day, because you don't get away from each other. Like Adam said, we are together 24/7, 7 days a week. We are always around, and that's not normal. You're not meant to spend that much time with somebody. But the crazy part is, I will say, when we actually are forced to go do stuff without the other, it's weird. Like when Adam did the Tomorrow's Horseman and he would have to fly here or there for the meetings for two or three days at a time, that was probably the first time that he really had to go spend days doing something that I wasn't going with him for. And it was very odd. Like, there's lots of times where you're like, gosh dang, I would give anything to just have 10 hours away from you. But then the second they're gone for more than an hour, you want to call them and be like, what are you doing? How's it going? Where are you at? Like, just, you're just so used to that person being there all the time. So it is something that is very hard to describe. for me.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have to add to that.
Adam's not going to add anything to that one.
I don't know. I feel like this is a trap.
He did. You did tell us before we started recording, though, that you wish you had two separate indoor writing arenas at your place.
Well,
so
I would love to have that out there. I would love to have a indoor. Just two outdoors would be great.
Okay, yeah.
Like just two different arenas, so that I can, like, she doesn't have to see the stuff. Like, it never fails. I always felt like that when I worked for somebody. They would always see it when I'm in the middle of something. Like, I have a plan. Like, this is going to work, but it's going to get worse before it gets better. So I just got to make sure they don't see it until it's better. And my wife has an uncanny ability to see something right in the middle of it. She'll look at me and I'm like, you don't need to watch this right now. Like, I know it's bad. Okay. Like, just don't even look at it right this second. Give me a minute. Like, by a minute, I mean a week. Like, look at it this time next week. Like, then tell me if it's bad. But no, everything she said is kind of just ditto for me. I think the biggest thing is you don't know how much. I think the biggest thing for us, it wasn't better. It was just, I definitely don't think it was better. I think it was easier before Mac came into the picture for us, because legitimately we had, to this day, we have two extremely huge TVs in our house. And both of those were won by Brody Gallion at the Sun Circuit running in the foot races. Brody was my ringer. And I can't remember what years they were won, but every year we'd go out there and Brody would be a TV. Like, that's how that works. So we had two extremely large TVs in our house, and I would go in one room and Paisley would go in another room, whether that be the living room and the bedroom or whatever. And you had your own set of shows. So for like a solid 3 to 4 hours, we would eat dinner, not at the table, not together. You know, all that you hear about a conventional family, making sure you have that family time.
That's our decompressed
time. And because we have spent the last 18 to 21 hours together and not like to the point that you don't need to hear that person talk, because you've already seen, you don't need to ask how their day is. You've seen how their day is. And she's way better about that than I am. She, you know, we try to not let the barn come into the house, and she's really good about that too. For me, it's very, very subconscious. Like, if I have a bad day in the barn, I can go upstairs or go into the house and still be in a bad mood because of what happened in the barn that day. Like, you know, everything was horrible that day, whatever. And be short and snippy. She's very the exact opposite. However, she can sit down over dinner now and bring that up to me. I have a hard time taking emotion out of that, because I have to take emotion out of it when we talk to the customers, or not just the customer. I have to talk to the public. So Paisley is very good at removing that emotion and just talking about it. I am not. Like, if that's my inner circle, you know, Paisley and I are best friends at the end of the day. I can't take that emotion away from that. So I need time to remove that emotion before I can talk about it. And that was really easy before Mac. Now that adds a whole new factor to it. And we take in our house, dinner time is very serious. I enjoy cooking. That's kind of my deal. And so I try to cook dinner every night. Paisley generally has to go into the house before I do to relieve my mom, who was also our babysitter. And so she's got Mac's routine. I try to cook dinner and we try to come together as a family. Doesn't always work that way, but that's what we try to do. And we're forced. It sounds bad to say forced, but you don't get your decompression time. Like, you both want to be with your child. So, like, you got it. For me, I think a lot of times it's me that has to, like, hey, leave it in the barn. Like, get rid of it in the barn so that you can go have dinner with your kid, you know? And I think it's been 11 months. It turns one in the 21st of this month. Yeah, we're getting close. And I think we're getting better about it. But when they tell you this is a learning process, I'm telling you, there's no truer statement. Like, I think it was a lot easier to be a couple training horses. Easier, not better. That's the biggest thing I can say. It's not better. It's just easier. Be a couple training horses. Figure your routine out. We were really, really lucky with that. Figure your routine out. We got 2 years of a dry run at Gills living together so that when we went out on our own, yeah, there were different challenges. But when we went to the house, we already knew how to deal with each other. And how to live and not, you know, Paisley had lots of practice not smothering me with a pillow in my sleep before we ever went out on our own. So we already had each other's routine down, knew that we needed that time. And then it just kind of worked that way for us.
I don't have children and neither does Liz yet. And I'm like, but I don't think I've ever met anybody that says they were prepared and knew what they were getting fully get into when they did have children. So I don't think you're unique there.
Yeah, no, that's the one thing everybody told us too, because Adam and I both knew that we wanted kids. And we kept kind of waiting, especially me. I was the one who really was like, I don't know, do we have X, Y, and Z ready? Like, are we ready to add a kid to this equation? And everybody always tells you you're never ready. But my parents were finally the ones that were like, look, you're never going to be ready. If you want kids, you just got to have them.
And I hate that statement. Everybody always tells you, you just figure it out. But I hate that. Like, that is so the opposite of the way that Paisley and I live. Like, you don't just figure it out. I hate that.
Wow. Are you a plan kind of a person?
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
I can wing it in a lot of ways. I mean, there are some things that I'm a big planner on, but for the most part, I can be like, roll with it. Okay, we're going to figure it out as we get there. Adam is not. Adam has a plan for the plan and a plan for the backup plan.
I'm with you on that, Adam. And I think Liz is too. And I'm married and she's engaged to people that are more like roll with the punches. Mm-hmm. So I feel like you have to balance each other out somehow.
Yeah. And I can roll with the punches when the adversity strikes. I'm good rolling at that point. Like, because I've already thought about, well, what if this happens? What if this happens? What
you
if
have
this
backup
happens?
Plans.
So, like, I think Steve Ream said it then. Steve Ream said one time that he's like the duck on the water. You look out there and that duck just cruising through that water, cool as a cucumber. And underneath them little legs, it's just getting it. And that's how I feel at times, like, when my plan maybe doesn't come. I'm okay if the plan shatters because I've got C, D, and E sitting there. I've already thought about them. I got them. Paisley, however, is good at looking like the duck on the water and being cool when the plan blows apart. And she only had plan A. And I'm sitting there like my hands are shaking. I'm like, oh, God. Like the veins start popping out. Places aren't supposed to be veins. I'm like, oh, no. This is horrible.
My plan comes together.
Yeah, see, yeah. I don't like that. I don't know how you live like that.
It's funny how it works out. You find somebody that's a little bit of your opposite in some regards for the perfect harmony. So let's talk a little bit about your philosophies on training and maybe the current state of Western pleasure in general. And I don't know if that's triggering to you guys, but training philosophies, start there. I guess we'll start there. Kind of what's your general premise?
So he's looking at me.
You're better at putting them into words.
Generally speaking, we are very, like he said,
she's way more analytical. That's why I'm looking at her.
I can talk it to death when it comes to how I like to do things. But for the most part, to keep it simple, every horse is their own. I mean, we definitely have our routine of things that, you know, when it comes to starting a colt, like, we want it to do A, B, and C before we ever try and climb on it. We want A, B, and C to be done before you come out of the round pen. Like, yes, we have our routines, but we also try to stay very much so that, okay, well, this horse isn't going to follow the norm. This horse needs more time here, or this horse needs less time in this position. Like, every horse is different. No two horses are going to train exactly the same. So I would say our biggest philosophy that we both agree upon is being willing to bend a little when one tells you that that's not how they need it.
Yeah, I agree with that 110%. Because there are several horses that, like, Paisley has her strong suits and I have my strong suits. And I feel like we tell each other what our strong suits are. We're not really good at admitting what our strong suits are. But I think there's times where I'll ride and I'm thinking, like, in the colt stage, you know, you start taking hips or taking faces, and like that's when you'll start seeing us swap a lot, because it's not a talked about thing. But if she steps off and something says, "Hey, I think you need to ride this horse," there's a reason for that, and I'll get on it and I'll love it because I get to work on what I like to work on, and it makes that horse better. Vice versa, you know, like I'll lope one around there and I'm like, "Paisley, you're gonna love this horse. I think you should ride it," and she'll get on it and it works. Rarely have we had that not, like, we'll trade back eventually. Like, there's a reason that we pick what we pick, or we'll, you know, Paisley be like, "I think, Adam, I think you need to start that one." Yes, that's great, because you're seeing when they get off the trailer and you're doing the groundwork with them, you see the big picture more or less. You see what their attitude's like. And while their attitude may fit my frame of thinking a little different or a little better, may suit me, I can put up with this or that or put the heat on this or that. The things that horse is good at naturally may fit into Paisley's wheelhouse. So she'll take it to the point where emotion or personality doesn't play into it, and then say, "Okay, you know, like, I'll give it to her and say, 'Hey, listen, I think you should ride it.'" She'll take it to that point and then say, "Hey, I think he's ready for you again." And when she gets there, I know, I've watched it obviously, but even if we were not in the arena with each other every day, if she tells me that, I know that when I get back on, A, B, and C are done. I'm down on X, Y, and Z at this point. Like, we're down to the, I'm not going to say the finishing touches by any stretch of the imagination, but the quote unquote maneuver ability is there. You know, it's doing A, B, and C because she worked on those pieces. So now I can go work on the pieces that I like and allow it to develop the personality that creates the picture that we all like, versus creating a horse that got, you know, maybe those personalities clash, and where I won't allow it to be, you know, I'm not going to sacrifice quote unquote individuality because of what, you know, what it does. Paisley will not sacrifice it, but Paisley will let that go and train with it, not around it, but with it in there, and it doesn't bother her. Whereas if it were on, you know, if it were standing underneath me, I sometimes can't overlook that. You know, I know what it's thinking, or I think I know what it's thinking, and that bothers me. So we try to swap back and forth quite a bit just with that. And then when we swap again, that seems to help. And we know when each other says that, we know what that means.
So I'm sure you guys maybe heard Katie Jo and Aaron's episode on the current state of the Western pleasure things. Do you guys have your own reflections or thoughts you want to share with us?
I'm going to let Adam answer this one. I know he's got.
Great.
He's got it.
You're on.
We've talked about this a lot before.
Yeah. I mean, we had some good discussions about it. To me, I think there was a lot of great points brought up in that podcast. To me, so the current state of that, for me, I think I do not see the Western pleasure as a dying discipline at all. I think, you know, the numbers at horse shows, by and large, I'm not going to say disprove it, but they don't, you know, they don't support that theory. I do think, for me, in the way that Paisley and I look at it, I think there's a lot of good points brought up in that podcast. The biggest thing for us, I think, that we tend to look at, you know, we don't think that it's a dying breed. We do, dying discipline. I think there's I'm not even going to say a problem. I think we need to focus a lot, maybe a lot more, on our feeder system. Our feeder system is extremely important, and especially, and I think the area that we live in tends, you know, makes us see that a little more. We don't want to become an elitist. We don't want to become, and I'm not saying that there's, you know, that Katie Joe and Aaron and or anybody is an elitist. I'm just saying that's something you want to try to not go towards. And then the cost of going to that horse show, you know, we are the introduction to the rest of that. I mean, I think that was even said in their deal. We are the beginning of all that. So I think that plays a part into it. And then that, again, I think another piece of that is public perception. And all three of those things go hand in hand to me. I don't think there's a quick fix. I don't think there'll ever be a quote unquote fix. I think it's an evolving process. You know, it's just not something that you can say is, yep, this is it. We got it nailed down. No, you're always, as a horse trainer, just a horse training mindset, you're always trying to make it better. So I see it from a positive. I think it's a very positive thing. And I think Paisley does too. But to me, the feeder system, and I say feeder system because I can't think of a better term to use, but that to me is being able to allow those people to come to that horse show. And when I say horse show, I'm not talking about the 15-day long circuit or the 10-day, 7-day run type of deal. I think I'm talking about the weekend. And us as horse trainers, being where we're at, fraternity horse trainers, you know, that's what we focus on. But go and support those state-level horse shows.
I think, Adam and I talk about it a lot, but I'm a firm believer in the fact that I think one thing that would really improve a lot of the problems that people, quote-unquote, have right now is if AQHA could limit the number of horse shows that are exceeding 3 or 4 days, except your world shows. Like, obviously, those have to be bigger. And there can be a few, a handful maybe, of those big circuits. But right now, I think we have so many circuits that are 10-plus days long that it becomes a very expensive horse show, and there's no way around it because you're there for so long, and the judges, there's so many judges, and there's so many things that go into it that I think if we went back to showing more weekend type horse shows and then only going to those handful of majors instead of trying to have 20 major horse shows throughout the year, it'd become a lot more affordable for the masses. Versus, like Adam said, that's to me evolved, getting away from pushing towards the elite that can afford to take that many days off of work and have that big expensive run time after time after time. But that's just, like I said, that's something we both, obviously, because we love it so much, we talk about a lot. And it's talked about a lot, I think, between most horse trainers. But I think a good way to get around that is if we would just make it a little more.
I'm not even going to say that it needs to. I agree with what you're saying. I think I'm not going to say that they need to limit per se, because to me, Dent DeBurr described it to me one time about something totally different, but he had a great way of explaining something with his involvement in the NSBA. He said, think about it like a ship, Adam. If you change that ship's course of direction 1 degree in 100 miles, how far off course are you? How far have you changed that ship's direction? And I think about that a lot, because you got to do it for the long play. So I understand there's a lot of, I think both of us do understand that's a lot. That's a short-term answer for a long-term process. But I agree. Like, we got really lucky. We're really lucky, you know, the Premier Sires and Joe Witt got together and they put together what they did right here, basically in our backyard at a 3-day weekend horse show. And we got to go show for money. And then what's even better is the first week in April, we get to go support. And this past weekend was right here at South Carolina Quarter Horse Association. We got to go support that. We were lucky enough to win money, but we got to go support that association. And then we get to turn around and go to a 4-day, quote unquote, 4-day weekend horse show in Williamston, North Carolina, the first weekend of April with the District 4 of NCQHA. And so We've been lucky with that. I think sometimes for me, I think the cost of going to those horse shows is what, you know, that would have been, and I'm sure that's a concern that my parents had coming from the background that I had, was the cost of going to those horse shows. And even today, we are lucky. We have a great group of customers that have very talented horses right this second, and they'll go with us wherever we want to go. However, when we go to develop somebody into a customer with a very nice horse, it makes it hard to build customers, and it makes it really hard to build horses when you're gone for 15 days in the middle of the month. And that, from a horse trainer's perspective, not taking money and everything else out of it, that makes our job extremely hard. But then you have to sell that. You have to talk to that customer and talk them into, hey, this is a good idea, you know? And that's tough. I'm not saying that. I just think there's so many big, long horse shows that have no choice but to be expensive because you're there for so long. Like, you can't stay somewhere. You can't stay in one spot for 10 days and it not cost a significant amount of money. Go to the Caribbean for 10 days. It's going to be expensive. It's either expensive up front when you buy it for your travel agent, or when you go down there and do it on your own, it's going to be expensive. So you can't stay in one spot for 10 days and pay people to judge you and pay people to run the horse show and have all those things and it not be expensive. And to the guy off the street, that's hard. It's hard for him to put his daughter or his son or that mom that's working three jobs because her son or daughter loved to ride horses. It's really hard to let somebody who cares about them like we do or like any other horse trainer is going to build them into something that they know they got to stop at some point because they can't afford to do it. They just can't. So,
like I said, that to me is why I think if we would just focus, it could solve so many problems in my mind if we would focus more on some smaller horse shows and not make so many big ones. Because it would also, I think one of the topics that so many people love to hit on is that the state shows are dying off. Well, that's because nobody has to go to a state show anymore. You know, a lot of people are pushing towards those big long runs and they pick and choose those runs that they're going to go to, and that's all they do. Well, if you take that away a little bit and make the 3 and 4 day horse shows the priority, then the state shows could come back and start rebuilding. And people would want to go to them again because they wouldn't be so focused on those big long runs.
And I do think time of the year plays a part into that too. I mean, like looking at, like for us, for our, the people that are in our barn, that it is a lot easier for the youth kids that we have, you know, that end of April or end of May time of the year to the beginning of August, you know? So in my mind, thinking of in horse trainer mind, the premier to the NSDA is extremely easy to get people to go to horse shows because their kids are out of school. Like, or they're, you know, maybe they're a school teacher and they're out of school. They have the time. And they're doing this because they're not as interested in having a boat and they're not as interested in having a motorhome. This is what they do on their vacation. So I think, like I said, in horse trainer mindset, when the premiere is done right there at that time of the year, the end of May, that is the sweet spot. And if you're going to have long horse shows, like those fraternities more or less have to be to accommodate everyone. That's the perfect time of the year. And the Congress is a mainstay. So you make that summer run and you have that Congress and you have that world show. Those are mainstays that have to be there. But let those horse shows, you know, there doesn't need to be as many giant horse shows at the beginning or the end of the year, if that makes sense, I guess. Like, you don't have to go there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you guys provide a unique perspective, and that's a nice balance between the, you know, what you said, elite long-run horse shows versus the state-level grassroots thing. And I think that's kind of where we all need to figure out. I don't know, you know, we haven't solved the how, but the where we need to get to is a better balance with that. So it's refreshing to hear your perspective as, you know, very credible high level horse trainers that you kind of feel the same way, I think.
Absolutely. And I definitely think that both Paisley and I both see it from a positive standpoint. Like, it's not a negative. It's just right. A positive, like, hey, I think we can make it better with this, because the way that it is right now, from what we see, is not a dying industry. We see an industry that is growing, but we see a way to put Miracle-Gro on it.
Well, for us, like Adam said, I think we constantly have people. I mean, we have several youth camps, and then we have people that are coming into the pleasure because their kids are graduated and now they want to show. But we have people that are coming into it new, quote unquote. So like Adam said, we definitely don't see it as dying. We see it as growing, but there definitely is ways to make it friendlier. I think to me, a really crazy thing is I'm not that old, or I don't consider myself that old, and neither does Adam, but I remember 15 years ago when the internet wasn't nearly as crazy. Now everybody has such a weird platform to tear anything down. It's not just the horse industry. I mean, there's so many ways that people just tear each other down on the internet that it boggles my mind a little to know that if everybody would just, if you can't say nothing nice, don't say nothing at all, the world would be a little bit better.
The internet is a wild, wild place anymore. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it. Like I said, it really, Adam and I have talked about it a lot. I think everybody has. It really shocks me sometimes the things that people will put on there. And it's just, I mean, I don't know why. Why would you say that? Why would you want to say that? What does it hurt to be positive? Especially if you love it. I mean, if you're talking about a sport that you love, why not act like it?
Mm-hmm. Amen to that. Before we begin to wrap up today, I do want to hear or touch on a little bit about Adam's experience with NSBA's Tomorrow Horseman. So you want to give us a little quick rundown on how that went for you?
I don't even know where to start. Like, I got goosebumps when you said it.
Amazing.
I can't thank the NSBA, Stephanie Lynn, Elite Sherrard, and Chad Horkey enough. The board members, I don't even know how to describe it. The people that allowed that to happen, it gave us the stability to start a family. As we talked about, I'm a planner, very much so. It's hard to describe the amount of gratitude I have for the people that are involved with that program. Yeah, the way they teach you. To me, when I went into it, I thought it was going to be a lot like school, you know? And I was really worried the whole entire time. I was really worried about leading up to it. I was really worried about, like, you know, I don't want to fail. I don't want to fail out of this deal. And then I realized it's about, you know, try. And the things they teach you, and it's not just the things, how they go about teaching you those things. It's a very positive atmosphere. And our group, class number two, is absolutely amazing. One of my best friends in the world. I knew her before, but Elise Roberts and I became really close in that class. You know, Kristen Lair and I became really close in that class. Dustin Eichenhorst and I. The networking opportunities that it provides you from just the networking opportunities are unbelievable. And then, and it's not just our class, it's the class that was before us. Then you go into the business side of things and being able to think strategically, you know, with a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. And like I said, at, you know, maybe a third or halfway through, I had kind of thought about it and come home with that information and talked about it with Paisley. And it has provided us the stability to start a family. Like, you want to talk about a program that changes somebody's life? That's not an easy decision. That's not a quick decision. And I don't say that lightly.
I think, not to interrupt him at all, but the one thing that my biggest takeaway, because obviously Adam would always try to keep me up to date on everything that was happening. And the easiest way to put it is there's so much to running your horse business besides working the horses every day. And there's none of us get to run the books when you're an assistant, which I wouldn't have wanted to, but it's something you're not prepared for. Running your actual, keeping your books up to date, knowing how to do your business taxes, all that stuff is so hard. But if you don't do it, you will be broke or not get your taxes done. All important things. And they teach you so much about how to correctly run your business when it comes to money and you're just keeping everything on the right path.
And I think correctly, they don't tell you, hey, this is how you got to do it. They just say, hey, you know, these are the issues that you're fixing to face. So how does it work for you to be ready to face those challenges? You know, whether that's shout out Chad Horkey, because that guy puts, nobody will know the amount of hours that Chad Horkey and Elise Sherrard put into this program. Like, I mean, it just, you'll never know it, but they give you like, hey, you got this coming at you. So how does it work into your life to get ready for those? It'll make you grow up in some facets, but by the same token, like I said, it just provides so much stability. You don't even know you're learning without knowing you're learning. You don't realize, you think you're there to complete the program. And like I said, for me, the light came on after I realized, I was like, man, this is something good after the first meeting. The second meeting, the second in-person meeting, I was like, oh man, so this is okay. So this is how you implement that. And by the third meeting, I think the second meeting is when the light really came on. And by the third meeting, I was chomping at the bit to get there. And honestly, it was hard to be done with. Like when we graduated, it was, you know, I was like, man, it's not over. I hated that I had to be done with it. I loved it. I loved every second of it. And I think my classmates, by and large, everyone feels that exact same way. When somebody's willing to invest the time that the NSBA and those people involved with that program invest in you. And then on top of that, the people that donate that money, those foundation members that donate that money, they think enough of horse trainers and by extension, you, to put not only the time, but the money into you. That's not something you take lightly. And you know, they don't even know you. They just trust that you're doing the right thing because here you are. And they're willing. That's what they want. They want people to succeed. And having somebody like that, somebody like Chad Horkey, somebody like Stephanie Lynn, somebody like Elise Sherrard, somebody like those foundation members in your corner that you can call on. I can't even express it. There's not enough words to say how great that is.
I was like, that is very well said. And I was going to halfway joke that you're saying you're a fan and you would recommend it for somebody in the future.
Yes, without a doubt. Do it. Apply.
Yeah. So as we wrap up here, is there anything we haven't covered that you guys want to touch on? And what is still kind of on your horizon for Mathis Show Horses in the near future?
Go for it there, Freckles.
Well, For me, well, both of us, but I know Adam always has a different way of wording it, goals, but I think we're both extremely grateful for everybody that we have to lean on and to go to. The Worst community is truly an amazing community. And we just really are excited about the future. I mean, like I said, we see it as a growing industry, and we're excited to be part of it and to be getting to go show horses as a living. I mean, we both love it, and we can't. I know. I mean, we both have an endless amount of goals. I think everybody does. But on the whole, it's just the fact that we get to go horse show, we get to train horses and work with horses every day. And that's our job. That's the best part.
So the future math of show horses to me is to continue to develop. If I had to write it down in one sentence, I mean, to continue to develop young horses into marketable, useful animals, be that, you know, in a competitive atmosphere. We want to develop competitive young horses. And that's where our heart lies. And we want to continue to do that. And also to develop customers. I thought about this earlier and I didn't say it. You know, we had a girl that had come in here, and she came in here with a hunt seat horse, and I wanted to share that story. She came in with a hunt seat horse, and I remember telling her dad, she was just at that stage of life where she was just out of high school. So she was kind of sort of going to school, and she's just kind of trying to find her spot. You know, like, she had some talent. Mom and dad had enough monetary backing to be able to send her to some horse shows. And the good Lord put this horse in her life that was competitive enough, you know. And I remember telling her dad, he was a little bit worried about, you know, I don't know what she wants to do, this and that. She showed so much promise, but she needed to work on it. And I said, hey, if we can keep her in this, that horse is going to take her places that she never thought she'd go. And he said, you need to tell her that. So I did. I said, you know, hey, listen, if you'll stick with it. She had one day, it was horrible. It was just one of those days. Nothing went right. She didn't know what we were going to do, you know. And I looked at her and I said, you know, if you'll stick with this horse, he'll take you places that you never thought you'd go. Don't worry about the boys. Don't worry about all the things that life throw at you. If you will stick with this horse, he will take you to the places that you didn't think you'd go. All right. When she came to us, her goal was to make the finals at the Congress in the novice amateur hunter under saddle. She ended up third, I think. But we started that in January. And the only time she heard her name from January until June was when we were yelling at her in the arena. You know, I mean, she didn't hear it through the loudspeaker. And then it clicked. And when it clicked, she rolled on with it. And that gives Paisley and I a genuine sense of gratitude. That makes us, that's why we do what we do. It's not just for the people, and it's not just for the horses. It's watching people. We want to continue to do that. You know, we want to continue to build a product that people want, but that people can use. And I think that's, as far as touching on stuff, I think we touched on everything. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, unless you got something else, Rex.
No, I think we talked about a lot, and really grateful for y'all's time, and we appreciate you wanting to talk to us.
Ooh, I got one thing. It was on the bulletin. I got one thing. The young people thing.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. Me, it's not going to be bad. The young people thing. I think the most important thing, apart from what we talked about with the time frame, I think the most important thing a young person can have is try. T-R-Y. You got to have try. If you'll stay hooked and try, I don't know one person in this industry. And that's the other thing I was going to say about the deal earlier with the, you know, the, where the industry's going and the evolution of the horse and all that. I think horse training, we see a lot of camaraderie, and I don't, you know, I can call Steve Reams right now and ask him, he's going to tell me truthfully. And if I beat him, he's happy for it. And if I don't beat him and he beats me, I'm happy for that too. I think there's a lot of camaraderie in the pleasure horse world. There's a lot of that. And I don't know one person, I can't think of one person that if you'll show them that you'll try, they'll give you that opportunity. All you got to do is show them you'll try and be committed to that try. Don't say I'm going to try for a month or 6 weeks or 8 months. Try for a year. And then if you'll try, if you set out to try for a year and 2 months, they're going to give you more than you ever thought they were ever going to give you in 3 years. And I don't know one person, I don't know one trainer that doesn't think like that. One successful trainer that doesn't think like that. So anyway, I wanted to throw that in there.
Well said. And I think that's a perfect way to wrap us up today. So do you guys want to provide contact information? I don't know if you still have any openings for clients or horses or anything like that, but whatever you want to provide, we'll take. If not, that's fair too.
Our contact information is mathisshowhorses@gmail.com or my phone number, which is Adam@843-319-3540. You can call or text Paisley@937-479-0494. Call or text. I don't suggest using the Gmail because I'm horrible. We collectively are horrible at answering emails, but we will find it. You can get a hold of us on Facebook, Matt the Show Horses on Facebook, Matt the Show Horses on Instagram.
Awesome. Liz, anything you have?
No, it was great listening to your guys' story. I love it.
Liz, I love this motorcycle, dude. Every time you haven't talked very much, but every time you talk, all I can see is this motorcycle. What is that?
It's an 883 Sportster Harley.
I wish Freckles would let me have that.
We're not diving into that topic.
No, she's gone. That's why I brought it up. She is legitimately the first time Liz talked came up and I was pointing at the computer screen. I was like, hey, I want that.
They're fun. Different kind of horsepower, you know?
Oh yeah, I'm all in on the kind of horsepower that don't eat. I'm all in on owning the kind of horsepower that doesn't eat.
It may be smarter than actually owning horses, which is hard to say. But yeah, I mean, nobody would get more credit to a motorcycle. But if you have horses, then a motorcycle probably is a safer bet.
Yeah, the only problem is that my addiction, it's ironic that I'm a pleasure horse trainer because I have an addiction to speed. I love going fast. I love it. And problem with like that motorcycle that Liz is sitting on is that my addiction to speed is answered with a mere twist of a wrist. Okay. Mm-hmm. So like the amount of protective gear that I would probably need, because while I'm addicted to speed, I'm also fairly uncoordinated, especially on two wheels. Like, not a good idea. I feel like I'd need a lot of protective gear. I'd suck all the cool out of that motorcycle. There's no way that I'm going to be able to sit on it and look cool.
You're safer on a pleasure horse.
Yeah, for sure. That's why I think that's why God put me here was to make sure I went slow.
Totally fair. All righty, Adam. Thank you, and thank Paisley for your time today. We really, really,
yes,
really appreciate you. I hope we didn't, all your story.
I hope I didn't take it too long. I'm sorry if I screwed up
not
the rest
all.
Of y'all's
nope,
interview.
We love
day.
It. You had a great story. Thank you, guys.
Yes.
Thanks. You bet. Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right, that'll be your class. Bring them in and line them up.